Here's a little hen on a certified farm with lovely fresh water and a nest that's warm. With tasty food and room to explore. Life is good with RSPCA Assured. If you're cutting down the meat, fish, eggs or dairy in your diet and want to support farmers who are passionate about the welfare of animals, look for the RSPCA Assured logo. Eat less, eat better. And for more information, visit rspcaassured.org.uk.
Welcome to the 442 podcast, where we dig into the biggest stories in football. In the new issue of the magazine, we look at Mauricio Pochettino's Tottenham Hotspur. In 5 years, Pochettino has taken them from seventh in the Premier League to the final of the Champions League. From a club that were once so synonymous with mediocrity that Alex Ferguson could eke a team talk out of simply saying their name, they've become a staple of Europe's elite competition. Poch has become the longest-serving manager at the club in over 30 years and has managed to oversee this transformation without spending big, with finances instead being invested in a state-of-the-art new stadium. So, how has he done it? What drives him? And what happens when he leaves? In this episode, we'll be discussing all of that, as well as Thomas Gravesen and the weirdest football transfers of all time. I'm Connor Pope, and I'll be talking to Hunter Godson, author of 442's latest cover feature on Spurs, and Nathan A. Clark, freelance journalist and contributor to the Spurs podcast, The Extra Inch. On the 27th of May 2014, Tottenham hired Mauricio Pochettino. He became Tottenham Hotspur's 10th manager in 12 years. There had already been two in the previous season alone with Andre Villas-Boas and Tim Sherwood. So let's start with that context. How did Tottenham fans feel about the 2013-14 system? Nathan, I'll come to you first.
Not great is the short answer. I think what was going on with AVB wasn't like horrendously terrible. Like his sacking maybe came a tiny bit early, but the sort of the regular thrashings we were receiving to other top six rivals were pretty painful. So like it wasn't unreasonable that he was sacked, but like things got a lot worse once Sherwood came in. I think results wise, like under Sherwood, it wasn't terrible, and obviously he liked to support that idea about himself as well. But the performances were like they were not going to last. We were heading in a terrible direction.
Yeah, Sherwood likes to remind everyone that he has one of the highest win percentages as a Spurs manager. That essentially is a nil point.
I did look this up beforehand, and I think there was one manager from the late 1800s who just about beats him. But I think maybe overall, I think that might have just been on a league record, and overall Pochettino is possibly now edging ahead of Sherwood and you know, in the Tottenham manager greats.
Yeah, and even if he isn't, I don't think anyone... cares about Sherwood.
So there wasn't any kind of annoyance when Sherwood was sacked. He was given an 18-month contract, but he only lasted, what, six?
He was given an 18-month contract, I think, because the club felt like they sort of owed him a level of respect because of what he'd done in the youth team setup. Mm. But, I mean, I was at his first game, actually, or one of his first games, I can't remember, but it was Southampton away. And I think we won 3-2. I remember Adebayor getting two. We played with Luka Modric and I can't remember the others. But we didn't play with a defensive midfielder. So right, basically, okay. Southampton would come forward, score a goal, and then we'd go forward and score a goal. And the game sort of just went on like that with no actual ebb and flow, no control of the game. And this is against a bad Southampton team at the time. And that sort of set the tone for the Sherwood.
Who was the Southampton manager at the time? Can you just remind me, actually? I'm just presuming it was Mauricio Pochettino.
Yeah, I got it.
So clearly Daniel Levy saw this game and thought, that's the guy I needed.
Well, yeah, we're conceding against him.
What do you think attracted Daniel Levy to Pochettino? Because he'd only had one season at Southampton and his job at Espanyol had finished when they were bottom of La Liga. So it's not like he came in as a kind of next superstar for certain.
He was doing some really impressive things with Southampton. He was sort of very softly linked to Spurs when we sacked AVB and we were looking around, but he'd only been at Southampton a couple of months. But yeah, he was doing some impressive stuff. He'd got some praise for his work at Espanyol, but then sort of things fell off towards the end for him there and they got relegated. But it was more about his style of play and his ability to get a Southampton, a fairly weak Southampton side, performing that way in the Premier League than it was about sort of any more obvious sort of accolades.
Yeah, there was definitely his work with some of the younger players as well didn't go unnoticed at both clubs, to be honest. And with Spurs rebuilding as we were at the time, and with the opportunities with some of the young players we had coming through, I think it was I think they clearly saw that we had a young enough team that he could come in and sort of mould that into a shape that he was happy with.
And do you think that focus on youth is the kind of guiding principle of his philosophy, if he has one?
I think it's not so much about like exclusively youth. Like, we're not talking about like under 25 players here, but like not already made megastars. Even the high quality players we brought in this summer are still on the young side, aren't like household names or anything. It's the coaching thing. It's being able to mold players to his will and his desire.
Yeah, absolutely. His man management style that all the players sort of talk about constantly. You read any interview and they just say, he just gets it. He knows how to make me feel better and more confident in the way I play.
How quickly do you think you could see a new style being implemented when he came in? Because, as you said, under AVB and Sherwood, it was some pretty turgid football. But now, I mean, 5 years on, everyone talks about Tottenham as being actually a really attractive team in the Premier League.
I think that first season, obviously, there was always going to be teething issues and they were still working out what the best team was. I don't think anyone could have said what the best team was when he came in. Getting rid of Soldado and bringing in Harry Kane, he was rewarded handsomely for doing that. And then sort of bringing through quite a young core to the team. Bringing players through, like putting Christian Eriksen in his preferred position, working in a few of the new boys. It looked better. If AVB was turgid, it certainly loosened up.
I guess what I'm trying to get at was, how quickly was there an excitement around it? Because AVB left, Spurs were seventh. They finished that season sixth, and in Pochettino's first year, I think he finished fifth. So it's not an immediate leaps and bounds onwards, but clearly there's a bit of progression in there. But at the end of that first season, was there a sense that this is going to be a long-term thing, this is quite exciting? Or was it just, this is a transitional year and we'll kind of see how it goes?
Yeah, so again, there's sort of like that vague similarity with AVB. Like, I think they want to play a similar style. And so I think AVB's biggest problem was that he couldn't get the team pressing the way he wanted. And again, with Pochettino, it took him quite a while to get that pressing game going. I think he sort of pulled his foot off the pedal a little bit in that regard in the first season to focus more on sort of general cohesion and not rubbing too many senior players the wrong way by asking too much of them in that first year. So we weren't there with all of the tactical ideas and we weren't there with the performance. But there was plenty of promise, but there was also, as there always is with Spurs fans, there was also some sort of worry that it hadn't overnight materialised into something amazing.
Mm. Oh, you spoke about his kind of man management and his coaching earlier on. There's a great interview with Dele Alli in 442 from April 2017, where actually it's striking to look back at it and see quite how much of the interview focuses on Pochettino's man management. We'd interviewed him the year before and it hadn't really come up, but in that year, Ali had become one of the most exciting young players in Europe, probably. So how big a strength do you think that is compared to especially other, you know, recent managers in the Premier League who possibly man management over recent years hasn't been a big strength for those?
Are you talking about Jose Mourinho?
I'm talking about a couple. Maybe, you know, Antonio Conte as well. I think you could probably put it into that bracket.
I think if you've got a young team, you have to be good at man management. And you saw it straight away, putting his arm around Eric Dier when he first joined and saying, you're going to be a really important part of the team, but you're going to have to play every position to get into the team. And explaining to players why they play certain roles and committing to the team in certain ways. Dele Alli learned to do it. Eriksen became a much harder runner. You saw it, he doesn't have to turn to players like Eric Lamela, but certainly that man management style makes players want to run that extra yard for him. And, you know, with his training sessions, you do have to run the extra yard.
It's quite interesting. On Dier, actually, sorry, something I've kind of been thinking about. It's interesting over the past few years how the spine of the England team has had a huge Spurs influence on it. Obviously, Dyer's played quite a lot. Kane is now captain. You've got Dele Alli. Kieran Trippier, obviously, he's left now. But that has been an enormous thing that actually, I don't think until quite recently, you would have really seen Tottenham as synonymous with the England team.
We have sort of normally had one or two players in the side, but certainly we're now at a stage where we're filling out the spine of the England team. And that's, you know, again, it comes back to coaching, his ability to mould players. And it does help that we've had a decent academy production and bought in good young players as well. But it's his ability to coach players and improve them over time. When we sort of talk about, we often categorise coaches as sort of either tacticians or man managers, but it's very much both. Like if you, again, coming back to pressing, if you want players to run until they're bleeding out the soles of their feet, like you've got to make them care about the cause. It's the same thing.
He seems quite openly emotional as well. I mean, obviously, there were tears in Amsterdam, which I think many people could understand. But you've also seen it a couple of times at press conferences, and he says that he cried when he left Southampton, even though that was only a year. Is there something in that that makes it easier to connect with him as a fan?
I think so. I think if you can see a manager's raw emotion about the whole project, I mean, that's how we all feel about it. And so when, especially you mentioned Amsterdam, when he's on the pitch on his knees crying, you can imagine most fans around the globe were also doing the same thing. I know I was in my pants running around my living room with my girlfriend shouting at me, not quite tears, but the other end of it. And but yeah, you want to see it. You can engage with that person. You can connect with that person. And so when things aren't going well, it hasn't happened that many times yet, but when things aren't going well, you can sort of, you know, there's the human element you go back to, and you can remember the good times and that he does care. And so people don't question whether he's loyal or not.
I wonder if I might be kind of going off in a slightly weird area here, but he also seems to be very spiritual. He talks about universal energy. I think he has a bowl of lemons on his desk to take away bad energy in the room, which is quite interesting. Do you get a sense that any of that he kind of puts into application within a football sphere? Or is this just a kind of like a separate part of his life that comes up a bit in interviews because it's a bit different?
No, I do think that ties in. I think there's sort of like a vague sort of cult leader presence about him. Like he's very he's very full on. I think he's quite authoritative and he's incredibly passionate.
Yeah.
So I don't know if he's saying, right, today we're going to recognise Energy Universal or whatever with his players. But I think he has that sort of spiritual approach. And he doesn't have a 100% record because sometimes like he's pissed players off or he's fallen out with player and once they're out in the colds, once you're done, you're done. So yeah, it's full on and it works most of the time with most players, but there is that also that sort of that negative side of when it gets too intense with him.
Yeah, absolutely. He films the players arriving and leaving at training. So
I didn't know that. That's
it's just like he wants to be in control of every situation and he wants to understand every situation. And I imagine for some players that's a bit too much.
Because one of the things Dele Alli said in that interview was that he can tell if something's off. And he'll take you to one side and be like, what's going on? How can we solve it? And he understands that actually stuff going on in someone's private life can really affect what happens on the pitch. Yeah. So is this a way of him, this kind of weird monitoring, being like something's changing their character?
Almost certainly. And I mean, any little, if he sees something's off, he'll get involved. And if he feels like something is done the wrong way, he'll also get involved. So a good example is GK and Kudu, who didn't have the best time at Spurs. He arrived to training on his first day in a really fancy car and Pochettino apparently went out and told him, no, we don't do that. We don't come to the first day of training in your fancy car because you don't understand the value of where you are. You haven't made it yet.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because you would kind of associate something with that with a, you know, slightly more old-fashioned English kind of manager. I know there's In the new issue of 442, there's that great interview with Chris Wilder, who again, actually, you look at him and you think he's an old-fashioned English kind of manager, but he's not really.
No.
And it opens with him seeing, I think, a green Lamborghini or something, and he's just like, oh, that's a bit cheeky. Like, who's brought that along? I'm not sure about that. Which is a great little kind of a contrast into the rest of his character, which isn't really like that.
It feeds into the Energy Universal thing that you haven't earned it, or at least you need to prove that you've earned it.
This comes back into a kind of, there's clearly a huge amount of attention to detail in his character. And he's a huge believer in that. I know, as well as filming players on their way into work, he changed the laundry detergent that was used to wash training kits and stuff like that at the club, because he thought that they would play different in a different kind of detergent. Mm. Obviously, you've had the big move to the stadium over the past few years. Do you know if he's been involved in anything in terms of that process at all? Obviously, famously, Arsene Wenger was enormously involved in the way that the Emirates was designed. Has he had any input in that, do you know?
Not that I'm aware of. I would like to think that he's had some sort of say or some sort of liaison going on, but very much as much as he's clearly working 20-hour days and putting all his time to extreme use reviewing footage of players arriving for training, there's also this very much the segmentation thing of I'm the coach, I'm the manager, this is my area, and the scouting players and the new stadium and that sort of stuff, that's not my job. So, as much as he's the things that he is involved in, he goes 100% on. But there's also a lot of stuff which is part of the traditional manager in English club aspects that isn't his role. Mm.
And you'd have to also fight Daniel Levy
to
make any changes to anything.
Well, I kind of want to ask about that relationship there now. What you've said about his attention to man management and that kind of thing, and the way that he brings up players through the youth ranks, even though it's not necessarily his one concern. But so you can clearly see how that fits into working as a manager under an owner like Daniel Levy, who has such a, over the past few years, I think a fairly austere approach, and for very good reason. What is that relationship like? And it feels a bit strained at the moment. Is this the start of a kind of bad patch for him?
No, I don't think so. So he recently, after the North London Derby, said, it's been one of the worst weeks of my time at Tottenham, but it's over now because the European transfer window is closed. And I think it seems like he's referring to Eriksen is still at the club, Vertonghen is still at the club, Alderweireld is still at the club. Mm. So I think it's been strained, and I think that we're now turning a page into a really healthy situation where, hey, hang on a second, look at the squad that we've got for this season. It's better than it has been under Pochettino, and we know he's a special manager. So I think there's a lot of... we've just been through a hard patch, so it's hard to recognise the positivity, but I think that will soon sort of be more obvious. So I think there's a positivity there. There may well have been a strain over that situation between the two of them, and I do think they are both sort of A-type personalities, and it's easy for there to be a clash there, as there is with any sort of chairman and manager situation. Mm. But I think, again, that segmentation means that they're probably not in communication that much on a day-to-day basis, I don't think. And they have their separate roles and they stay out of each other's way most of the time.
That's not to say that Pochettino wouldn't love to be more involved with certain areas of what Levy does. certainly when it comes to buying and scouting players. Obviously, there was a couple of flare-ups this summer where he said, I'm not there, I'm not doing that, that's what Daniel does. And, we'll see if this comes to a head again in next summer, because there are a few players out of contract now that if they go for free... Spurs will be left out of pocket and three or four very good players down.
Yeah, so this is Vertonghen, Alderweireld, Eriksen. And so we are getting a sense there, as Nathan said, about Pochettino's authoritarian kind of streak in him. Do you see them getting back into the team at all this season?
They're all already in there. I don't think there was any real fallout between him and the players, but there is definitely an issue with contracts and the players. Mm. But again, he doesn't deal with that side of things, so that's on Levy to sort of resolve.
So he's now one of the longest-serving Spurs managers ever, the longest one since the mid-80s. But do you see what is happening at the club at the moment as a Tottenham Hotspur project or a Mauricio Pochettino project? Could it outlast him if he does leave?
Yeah, it could. If we manage to, once again find our way into a manager of his quality, that's obviously a big ask. It is a Tottenham project before it's a Pochettino project. I think we talked before about the time before he arrived with VS Boas and Sherwood, and yes, those were troubled times, but they were part of a general up trajectory that we'd seen over the last decade under Levy and Enoch. And yeah, it's the Tottenham project, but Pochettino is the key piece in that project.
But do you see a culture within the club, has that changed, that would outlast him, do you think?
But there's certainly an expectation change. There's a shift. When you come in the top four as many times in a row as we have now, there's certainly an expectation, and everyone just wants to keep moving that next step up. And you've seen Levy splash more cash than he's ever done before.
Yeah.
That's a big statement from him. And we might go out again in January and do the same thing. You just don't know.
Hunter, in your article, you write about Pochettino talking about how he feels he needs a trophy in his sixth season. Do you agree with that?
God, it's such a hard question now, isn't it? I mean, there are a finite amount of cups that you can win. I've said this to you before, and Manchester City are in all of them. And the problem is, they want to win all of them now.
Yeah.
It's not like it was 10 years ago when, the Carling Cup was like, yeah, we might win it. If we get to the semi-final, we might play our proper team.
Mm.
Now, everyone feels that pressure because of how fans are now. Everyone wants a trophy, and that's the only way of deeming success. When really, getting into the top four consistently is successful, and competing in those cups is important.
Mm.
But realistically, if you get to the final and you're playing Manchester City, good luck to you, because my goodness, they're good.
Do you ever look back on that second season he was in charge when Leicester won the league and think that's a bit of a missed opportunity?
It was a missed opportunity, but I don't think it's like our time has been and gone. I don't think that it will never come around again. Like, Guardiola's not going to be at City forever. Things can go wrong for other clubs. If we're there, if we're regularly finishing third for the next few years, then we're in with a shot of... And if we keep making it to the Champions League final, like, so eventually things are likely to go our way. I don't think that, like, our chance has gone.
Mm. I think everyone just wants to be competitive. I think that's the really important thing. And that was one of the only issues I had with the City game. We got a draw. That was fantastic. What an amazing result. But we're so far behind them as a project. But we are moving forward. So it's important to keep going in the Champions League, keep doing well, but then do well in both the Cups. And not shying in anything this year, because we do have a lot more depth than we once had, except for a right back where we should have.
I guess it's like Jurgen Klopp a bit at Liverpool, isn't there? That he'd been there a few years, they'd not won anything. There were some people, I mean, I'm not sure you'd give them much of the time of the day, but there were some people who said that Klopp was a failure because he'd not won anything. And then he won one game. Like, he got to the Champions League final the year before, so in essence it was only one game different, and now basically no one can make that argument. Is that basically the same thing with Pochettino?
You can make that argument, but I don't think it's a worthwhile. There's a lot of similarities there. Or Liverpool have a significantly better budget than Tottenham, although obviously Tottenham spent well this summer. But like, you don't get a parade for like successive Champions League qualifications and making it to the final. But like, that situation, Pochettino is one of the best managers in the world, and calling out for trophies doesn't change that at all. If you come back to the question, does he need to win a trophy? Like, I need to breathe in order to stay alive. Like, where's the end of that? Like, does he need to win a trophy in order to have succeeded at Tottenham? No. Does he need to win a trophy to be a legend? Probably not. Does he need to win a trophy to be considered one of the top five managers in the world? No, because I think he already is. I think that's very clear.
Yeah, absolutely. But like you said, he has shifted his own narrative here, which is, like I said, whether he'd admit it or not, it's a big shift for him, saying that he needs to win a trophy. He's never said that before at Spurs. So whether he feels like his time is not coming to an end, but coming to a crescendo, that would suggest yes, and that he feels like he needs to prove something now with the squad that he's built.
But at the same time, it's starting to look for the first time as though he might be serious about leaving at some point in the not too distant future. Do you think that is a serious prospect?
It seems like he wants to put an exclamation point on his time at Tottenham. He was talking about leaving when we were in the week coming up to the Champions League final. I do think that one of the reasons he was saying that was to sort of distract from any sort of player rumours. But there's probably plenty of truth to that as well. I don't doubt it. If he wants to say, I've won the Champions League with Tottenham Hotspur, by the way, who finished seventh the season before or something, and then move on, I think that makes a lot of sense. So if he's saying, I need to win a trophy this season so that I can call this a complete project, then yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, I agree that I think the Champions League talk was slightly to detract from what was happening, the madness and the chaos of the PR whirlwind that was going on around him.
Because his point as well was, if we win, I'll leave.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is quite an interesting way of doing it, isn't it? Is no one's going to be kind of put off winning the Champions League because the manager because might leave.
And I think most fans would have said, well, fair play, if you win the Champions League, off you go into the sunset. He did speak about going back to Argentina.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you can totally understand that. Is there a harder task than winning the Champions League with Spurs? In management, probably not. So you've sort of completed everything there, mate. Congratulations.
Oh, how many clubs do you think he might leave for? Obviously, we talk about Real Madrid, and then there's talk about Man United. There's chance both of those could become vacant at some point in the next season.
Yeah, you'd probably say there's a finite amount of clubs. You'd probably say, size-wise, it's Juventus, Real Madrid. He said he'd never go to Barcelona. And so, Bayern Munich, maybe, but realistically...
Yeah. He played at PSG, would they?
Yeah, he has ties to PSG.
PSG,
I think.
Yeah, that's true, potentially. But again, there.
But those are the only ones that you really see.
I don't see him going for another project in Europe.
Mm. What about United? Were they in your list?
They weren't in my list, but I don't consider them to be relevant in this list.
You don't think?
I don't see what possible reason there'd be for going to Manchester United.
So they are not a million miles dissimilar to us in the sense that they bring through a lot of players through their academy. And if you can mix in sort of what we've done this summer, mix in the sort of the reliance on academy players with also a handful of the big budget signings as well, I think that does appeal to him. I wouldn't rule out him going to United, but I don't think he's in a rush to go there either.
Yeah, I think there's also a sense of, in a way that... what Alex Ferguson once famously said about Spurs, lads, it's Tottenham. And that kind of summed up in that what everyone kind of believed about Tottenham at the time. Certainly you wouldn't be able to get away with that in a dressing room anymore. But I do think there's also still an element, even after 6 years, of lads, it's Man United. Like, this is going to be one of the biggest clubs in the world, regardless of whether they come second in the Premier League or seventh. Like, that can still be a huge pull on a person. I can imagine him still wanting to go for that.
Yeah, fair enough. If that's what you know, obviously, I'm biased here. I see Man United as being miles behind Spurs in their project, and so for him, it would be like hitting the restart button and going over there. Look, the money will be amazing. Like you said, the audience at Man United is second to none. They have the most fans in the world. Mm. It's just whether he'd want to do that, you know, and who knows.
So finally, if he did leave, who would be the kind of manager that you would want to replace him?
Someone as close to him as we could find, essentially. No names are coming to mind, obviously.
I mean, Eddie Howe has been brought up in the past.
Yeah, Howe I'm not 100% on. I would... That's something I'd really want to do, like a big... When the time comes, like a big... deep dive on who are the players who play like he does, who aren't sort of established massive names. Like, there's talk of like Jose Mourinho at the moment. It's just like, why? For what reason? I don't think we need sort of some yesterday's manager who everyone is familiar with. I think we want to find another Pochettino. But that time isn't yet.
No, it's not yet. Absolutely not. But, you know, there are names that are being thrown around. Jose Mourinho is one. If you're looking for a similar sort of man, Diego Simeone, and then you've got as a younger model, Hasenhüttl.
I was just about to suggest Hasenhüttl.
Yeah.
Do you think he's that kind of same?
I absolutely love the way he plays. He plays a five-player press, which is brave and great to watch. Whether that will work with the current Southampton squad is yet to be seen, but I do respect and I enjoy the way that he plays, or tries to play anyway.
Also in the new issue, we spoke to former Everton and Celtic midfielder Thomas Gravesen. And yes, I know what you're thinking. And we did ask him about how the hell he ended up playing for Real Madrid.
The main thing is my agent called me and I was in the cinema with my brother. And he called me and I said, I've got to take this phone here. So I went outside and we were saying, he said, what do you think about Madrid? So I thought it was Atletico Madrid to begin with. So I said to him, yeah, but I like Everton too, you know. It's Real Madrid, he said. So I went like, it's Real Madrid. Okay.
The Thomas Gravesen move to Real Madrid then is a complete classic of the genre. We pushed out the question, what are your favourite weird transfers, out on Twitter this week, and loads of people came back with Gravesen. I think for a lot of people, it is literally the first thing that you think of. But we got a few other great ones. Another one to Real Madrid was Julian Faubert. Loads of people brought that up, especially as there is such a fantastic photo of his presentation with the Real Madrid shirt with a frankly bewildered looking Alfredo Di Stefano, which really sums up that one, I think. Ryan Nelson and Luis Saha to Spurs actually came up quite a lot. What do you guys make of that one?
It's an infamous one amongst Spurs fans because we were pushing towards the title at that stage. A crucial January window opened up. We've got depth issues in the squad, and then we sign an aged Luis Saha and a frankly below our level Ryan Nelson. And it's sort of a stick that is to this day used to beat Levy. You know, he doesn't back the manager, but obviously that's now out of date. So it's an interesting relic of
As a Blackburn Rovers fan, I'm a huge Ryan Nelson fan. I mean, at the time you signed him, I think he was about 35. Obviously, you just needed a centre-back. It was the last day of the transfer window, the January transfer window. You got him on a free. But he also only played one game for Blackburn that season because of a knee injury he'd had, which I think possibly...
Quality signing. Just a...
Actually, my favourite thing about this is that in the last issue of 442 we had, in the season preview issue, we had Harry Redknapp. And he talked about it. And he said, well, actually, I would have preferred to sign Luis Suarez from Ajax, but my hands were tied. Except for the fact that Luis Suarez had signed for Liverpool a year before he signed Luis Saha. Yep. So I'm not quite sure
It's just a classic Redknapp quote, really, isn't it? I would have signed him, but, you know, forgot.
Victor Valdez to Middlesbrough a couple of years ago. That's a great one.
Yeah, brilliant signing, that.
Ali Dia to Southampton, of course, is...
A classic.
Graeme Souness convinced that it was George Weah's cousin after a phone call. I think he lasted, 33 minutes, 27 minutes?
That's not bad, you know, 33 minutes for being...
How long do you think you'd last on a Premier League football pitch without someone noticing that you weren't a Premier League footballer?
I could do 10.
Yeah, I think...
10 in goal.
Like 4 and I'm out. I think as soon as I'm getting on, people are asking questions. The first sprint. Edgar Davids to Barnett. Joe Bruin, the digital editor of 442, he brought this one up. That's a personal favourite. I think he played 9 games for Barnet. He got 6 yellow cards and 3 reds.
Was that a player manager position as well?
Yeah.
And he got sent off as the manager multiple times.
Brought himself on and got sent off a couple of times.
But yeah, David, as well as being player manager, played in the number one shirt, which I think is...
The arrogance there is unbelievable.
Joe Cole to Coventry City in 2015. Anyone remember that?
No.
I
mean, he made a lot of moves very quickly towards the back end.
Yeah,
of his.
Literally someone could have sent this in and I've not checked it and it could be wrong. But apparently he played with a young James Maddison there. Similarly, Samuel Eto'o going to Everton.
Yeah.
I'd completely forgotten about.
Great transfer that, though.
Robert Pires signing for Villa in 2010. That's a great one.
God, in 2010, that's
worryingly
recent.
36-year-old Nicholas Anelka going from West Brom to Juventus.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
That's a great one.
Anelka had a few great weird moves.
Yeah, he did.
He went to, you know, City and then Liverpool and then Bolton. Mm. Bolton, I mean, around 2002, 2003, they had Ivan Campo, Yuri Djorkaeff and JJ Okocha all signed for them in a space of 12 months. I think that is... That's got to be up there with the best periods of just bizarre transfers going on.
Bolton life, yeah, definitely.
I think for a while, it's probably been eclipsed now because sort of Neymar's gone back and forth, but for a while Anelka had the record for like cumulative transfer fees because he'd obviously moved again and again and again for like a moderate amount.
I feel like Robbie Keane did as well for a bit.
Yeah, he did. He was definitely up there.
That move from Wolves to Inter, which frankly, a great weird transfer. That was quite a lot of money for the time. So I think, and then he had a lot of moves after that.
Yeah, I like Nicholas Bentner to Juve on loan after failing the season before.
There's a brilliant clip of him being going around the internet this week of in training doing one-on-one practices against the goalkeeper and missing every single one.
Oh no!
Nathan, I think you had one more that you wanted to bring up.
So there's the Spurs. A popular Spurs one. I'm going to pronounce his name wrong, but Bongali Kamulu, who at the 2010 South Africa World Cup, I think he played for them. I don't know if he was even a starter for them, but I think we signed him. It smacked of Daniel Levy. I think we signed him as like a win over some South Africa fans because they've just been watching their country. They're all excited about their country. Now one of their players has gone to Tottenham, and then like he arrived in training, and it's sort of like a small time Ali Dia thing in that he didn't get on the pitch because he arrived in training, and it's like, oh right, this is like a semi professional.
What position did he play?
So he was a centre half. He played quite a few minutes for under 23s, not because like there was any threat of him like actually progressing anywhere, but just like to be a senior player for a bunch of kids and also to fill in there whenever we had injuries there. But he went out on loan a lot as well, just as a means of getting his wages off the books.
I mean, I'm sure Harry Redknapp's excuse there was, well, I wanted to sign Rio Ferdinand off West Ham, but you know. Nathan Hunter, thank you so much for coming in tonight. You can find Hunter and Nathan on Twitter at Hunter Godson and at Nathan A. Clark, and myself at Connor Pope. You can buy the new issue of 442 in shops now or online for £5. And while you're at it, you can subscribe and get 5 issues delivered straight to your door for just a fiver. If you've enjoyed the podcast today, please do drop us a lovely rating, a review on iTunes, and don't forget to subscribe. Thanks very much for listening. The music you've heard is by Howl Griff.
Like creating your own unique bets, the Betfred. With our Pick Your Punt Builder, you can choose from thousands of combinations. How many corners, who'll score, and how. The best part is, you get your odds instantly. Unique bets and instant odds with Betfred's Pick Your Punt Builder. Available online and on the Betfred app. Whenever you bet, Betfred. 18 plus T's and C's apply. Selected events only. Markets made available at Betfred's discretion. BeGambleAware.org. Set your limits. When fun stops.